So we're going to look at Philippians chapter 1. Philippians chapter 1. I'll just give you a moment or two to find it. So which version of the Bible are most of you using? Do you normally use the NIV here or the ESV or which one? All sorts. All sorts. Okay. I'm using the NIV. I hope that's okay. One particular verse in the one I'm reading to you is clearer in another version. So, Philippians chapter 1, we're going to read from verse 12 through to the end of verse 19. Now, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. As a result, it's become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for Christ. Because of my chains, most of the brothers in the Lord have been encouraged to speak the word of God more courageously and fearlessly. It is true that some preach Christ out of envy and rivalry, but others out of goodwill. The latter do so in love, knowing that I'm put here for the defense of the gospel. The former preach Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing that they can stir up trouble for me while I'm in chains. But what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached, and because of this, I rejoice. Yes, and I will continue to rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help given by the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance. God will bless his word to us. So, we're going to be talking... Well, I guess what I should have said at the very beginning is that this is Paul speaking. So this is the experience of Paul, that great evangelist, preacher, teacher. Wrote half the New Testament, it seems, sometimes. This is his experience. He's having a really, really tough time. He's put away in prison. We'll talk about that in a moment. But he's saying that I know that what's happening now is going to turn out to my deliverance. Let me give you a little bit of background to this before we go any further. You will notice in the reading I just brought to you, and you and I read the same words, I don't know about the others, where it says palace guard. We need to make it clear who these people are so we understand exactly who it is that Paul is with and why he's been put into prison with those particular individuals. Now, in many of the other versions, they're just called the Praetorian Guard. And it's important to know who the Praetorian Guard really are. They are, in fact, Rome's Imperial Guard. And some versions of the New Testament, I'm sure, use that particular term rather than the others. So they're Rome's Imperial Guard, and they were formed by the Emperor Caesar Augustus in the first place. He had about 10,000 troops who were part of this guard, and they were his personal guard. And mostly they were centered around Rome itself, though later on they spread out a little bit. Indeed, further on, one of the other emperors increased the numbers to about 16,000. So they were very, very important, these people. They were very close to Caesar. In fact, some of the Caesars must have thought they were a little bit too close because the Praetorian Guard actually assassinated 8 of the Caesars, and they were very much implicated in and complicit in the assassination of 2 more. So they were really close to Caesar, almost too close. They were, in a very real sense, kingmakers. Nobody argued with the Praetorian Guard. They were far too important. And they were really, really important too because their influence on Rome didn't end when they stopped being members of the Praetorian Guard. In the first place, they used to do 12 years, and then they would retire with a nice fat paycheck and with the respect of the whole of the Roman Empire for the rest of their lives. Later on, that was extended, and they were forced to serve for 16 years. But when they retired, many of the Praetorian Guard went on to a position within the Roman Empire, which continued to have real influence. They went into the higher echelons of business. They often went into politics. And everybody looked to them for their opinion for the health and well-being of the empire. Now, Paul is placed with these people, these really influential people. And their influence was very strong when he was with them. Their influence was very strong when the individuals were still members of the Praetorian Guard. But that influence continued even after they'd retired. Paul was put in that place with those people for a very important reason. Because they gave him a road to Caesar. That his influence would reach out far beyond that room. Now, we talk about him being in prison. Of course, Paul's prison was rather different from what we think of as prison. I mean, for a start, he was chained to one of these Praetorian guards. It was a chain that was called an halluces, and it was like handcuffs with about 18 inches of chain between the two people. So he was very close to his captors. It wasn't that he was locked up in solitary confinement all day with the guard outside the room. But whatever conversations Paul had, the guard overheard. Whatever prayers he prayed, the guard overheard. So Paul's influence was very strong upon those who were manacled to him. And of course the prison was different too, because Paul had the privilege of being able to buy his own accommodation. So he wasn't locked up in a maximum security, but nevertheless he was under close arrest. And so he rented his own prison. It seems really weird, doesn't it? And if I'd got arrested on the way here for going too fast, I say no more. And I got put in prison, it would be very different, wouldn't it? I couldn't say, well, actually, I'd like my prison to be in Pantigassing, thank you very much. No, it doesn't work like that. But Paul was allowed to rent his own place, but yet, nevertheless, he was very much under close arrest. However, he was allowed visitors. So people from the local church, other folks who wanted to talk to Paul, could just rock up at the prison, and he could have conversations with them. So these Praetorian Guard are going to listen into every conversation Paul has. And of course, he's chained to them every moment of every day. It doesn't come at 6 o'clock at night and everybody says, right, I'm clocking off now, I'm leaving you on your own, Paul. But every 6 hours, the guard changes. But he's still manacled 24 hours a day. So that's four guards every 24 hours. And he's there for 2 years, mark you. So think how many members of the Praetorian Guard he saw. And think how that influence reached out when they went back to their families and say, do you know what I heard today? Wow, this bloke Paul. Yeah, I was chained to him. And he had some people come to him. And they talked about the way that the gospel was spreading, despite the fact that he was in prison. And those conversations would have been a fantastic testimony to the Praetorian Guard member who was manacled to Paul. It's very interesting the way that God manoeuvres this whole situation for his own glory, and I'm sure for the salvation of souls. And yet, you know, we look at this and we think, well, yeah, he was in prison, but it wasn't too bad. He wasn't in a maximum security place, and there were no other prisoners there who were giving him a hard time. He was allowed visitors, so maybe it wasn't too bad after all. Maybe Paul was okay. But actually, when you look into the character of Paul, you realize that this is a real tough time for Paul. Think about who he is. Think about his personality. Here was a man who loved to preach, a man who loved to go out on the street corner and evangelize as people came past, a man who just loved to communicate, a man who loved to travel and wherever he went, to establish churches and to meet people that he'd never met before and tell them the gospel. And then he loved to go back to the churches that he'd established. This is a real action man, a real man who loves to get out and do stuff. Yet here, he's in a completely different situation, and many of us would have absolutely hated it. He really was somebody with no privacy now. No privacy at all, not even for 5 minutes a day. Here is a man who loved to get out and do all sorts of stuff, but now he's got no freedom at all and no opportunity for the sort of evangelism that he's always loved to do. But the first thing we see here is that appearances are deceptive. Appearances do not communicate truth in all cases. Don't be deceived by your circumstances. Look at what it says in verse 12. I want you to know, brothers, says Paul, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. Now, the way Paul says this is really important, and this is a theological term that I'm sure you're familiar with, but Paul loves to use terminology like he does at the beginning of that verse. He says, I want you to know, brothers. It's called a disclosure formula, okay? And Paul loves to do that. 10 times in the epistles, Paul says the same sort of thing. And I'll tell you where, not in great detail, but in Romans twice, in 1 Corinthians 3 times, in 2 Corinthians, in 1 Thessalonians, in Galatians, here in Philippians and Colossians 2, Paul says, I want you to know, or a slight variation of that. He either says, I want you to know, or he says, I don't want you to be unaware. And you know, whenever Paul says, I want you to know, or whenever Paul says, I don't want you to be unaware, that whatever's coming next is important. That whatever's coming next is something that you should listen to very carefully. In effect, he's saying, listen up, pay attention. I'm going to say something that you need to hear. And why does he say that here? He says it first of all, because he loves the brothers. He loves the church. He said, listen up, because what I'm going to tell you is such good news, and I love you enough to want you to know that you don't need to worry about me. Don't be discouraged. Don't be concerned about what's going on. You may have heard rumors, but don't be concerned about it. Don't worry about me. I'm not the important one here. Far more important than the seemingly bad news is the great news. Far more important than my imprisonment is your freedom to preach the gospel. The gospel which is advancing because I'm here. And I looked up that word advancing to find out exactly what it means. And I found that it was a Greek word, propake. And it's a military term. And it doesn't mean what you think it does, unless you already know. Because actually, what it means is to make progress by getting rid of the obstacles. And the emphasis is on the fact that the obstacles are being removed. So an army that was on the move that might have been held up by trees or by undergrowth, those trees and that undergrowth would be removed. And that is involved in the idea of advancing. So what Paul has said here, and his listeners will understand it, though we don't, is that the gospel is being advanced because the obstacles are being removed. His being put in prison is a means by which the obstacles to the gospel advancing are being removed. It's a very important thing to understand. And Paul is doing two things, really. He's accepting that there are obstacles to the growth of the gospel. And I'm really good he's honest about that. I'm really pleased he's honest about that. Because you and I know that there are things that would seek to get in the way, don't we? The world would seek to get in the way. The devil would seek to get in the way. There would be people of other religions who would seek to prevent the gospel from growing, who would stand in the way. There are all sorts of obstacles. But when the gospel is advanced, those obstacles are moved out of the way. It's just important to take that in. So he's also telling us that the obstacles, which may seem huge, trees look pretty big to me, the obstacles which may seem big are movable. They are dispensable. Under the power of God, no obstacle is so big or so impressive or so scary or so imposing that it will prevent the growth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. There is no obstacle powerful enough to prevent God's will from being done. God's purposes and plans cannot be thwarted, no matter who it is that stands in its way, no matter what the circumstances are. God's will happen. That thrills me. Verse 13 says, it's become known throughout the whole imperial guard, throughout the whole of the Praetorian guard, and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. This is great, ladies and gentlemen. Four guards a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. For 2 years, Paul is locked up. And what does he do? Does he sulk? I think I probably would, if I'm absolutely honest with you. Does he feel sorry for himself? And again, I think I probably would, but there's no sign of that with Paul. Does he feel that God has abandoned him? Does he complain? Does he sit in a corner and scream at God, "Do you know who I am? Do you know what you're missing when I'm locked up in here? Do you understand that the gospel would go forward so much more easily if I was out there than in here?" He doesn't do any of that. He understands that actually, although he's a great preacher, he understands that even though God has used him, God can get by without him, even Paul. So what is Paul's response to his imprisonment? I find this rather encouraging. Verse 18, he says, two words, "I rejoice." So he's talking about what he's doing now in the circumstance in which he finds himself. And he's saying, "I'm in prison, I'm shackled to this big hairy guard, I have no privacy, I have no opportunities to get out of this place, but I rejoice." See, what does that imply? What does that imply? Well, first of all, it implies that he knows the God that he serves very well, doesn't it? It implies that he knows that the God that he serves is utterly dependable. He's never let Paul down before, and he's not going to let him down now, and he won't let him down in the future. This is important. It's important for us. Now, I don't know you very well. So I don't know how you've suffered in the past, and I don't know how you're suffering right now. But I do know that probably for all of us, we will have to face suffering in the future. Yeah. And here is perhaps the most important thing I'm going to say to you now. If you want to be able to rejoice in really difficult times, like Paul is going through, you need to prepare long before the difficult times come. That doesn't mean to say that God won't be with you in difficult times, even if you haven't, he will. But nevertheless, let me say that if you get to know God so well in the good times, if you learn to depend upon God in the good times, if you learn how precious he is through his word, through prayer, through fellowship with brothers and sisters, if you learn all of that in the good times, that when the bad times roll, you have something to look back on. An old lady who'd had a really difficult life said to me, "Every day I climb closer to God. And then circumstances come along and they knock me back. And I fall down the stairs. But every time when I start climbing again, I'm one step higher than I was last time I fell." We need to know God really well now. We need to know his word. We need to know his presence. We need to know how to recognize his voice so that when the bad times come, we have a basis, we have a solid foundation upon which we can place our rejoicing. But Paul doesn't just say, I rejoice now. He also says, I will rejoice, doesn't he? He says, and do you know what that is? That is not an emotional response. You might say that the first thing, I'm rejoicing, that's emotional. But he goes further than that. He says, I'm going to rejoice in the future. That is not an emotional response. That's a decision, ladies and gentlemen. And you see, so many Christians, they think it all depends upon how they feel, and it doesn't. Sometimes we need to grit our teeth and say, I will. But people think love is all about, you know, hearts and flowers. Just at my 40th wedding anniversary, and people think that means 40 years of unremitting glee. My wife will tell you it doesn't. Sometimes when we're told to love our wives, our brothers and sisters in the church, that's real hard. And even harder for you to love me, let me tell you, if you knew me better. So at times like that, we make a decision. I am going to love. I may not feel like loving. I know that in the future I won't feel like rejoicing. But nevertheless, I am going to do it. And it's a real decision that sometimes in the hardest circumstances, I'm going to hang on in there, despite the blows, despite the frustrations, despite the seemingly inescapable circumstances that I'm in, I will rejoice. And Paul makes a statement here. He draws a line in the sand and he says to the devil and his enemies and all the rest, you cannot take my joy away from me. I will rejoice. And it's important we understand that when the hard times come, we need first of all to have a real experience of God's presence in the days before that will serve us well in the hard times. But then sometimes we need to just grit our teeth and say, we are going to rejoice. But then, you see, there's something else here. In verse 19, Paul says, I am absolutely certain, he says, that this will turn out for my deliverance. He knows that God is dependable. He knows. And it's all this stuff about proving God in the past. Bye, Victoria. God bless you. Right, we can talk about it now. He knows. He knows that God will not let him down. He's never let him down before. Why would he start letting him down now? So the strength of Paul's testimony is that he knows God and he has total assurance that God will never let him down. And this will turn out for his deliverance. And folks, we're going to be delivered. You and me. We're going to be delivered. And that may mean that God will touch us and we'll be healed. And it may mean that somebody will do something that will change our circumstances. It may mean that things will change. But if it doesn't, we're going to be delivered anyway. Isn't it true? We are going to be delivered. We've already been delivered from so much. But the fact is that when this life ends, we're going to be delivered from suffering and from tears and from concern for the future and all of those negative things that haunt human existence. We're going to be delivered from it. And we're going to heaven. Hallelujah. A friend of mine is desperately ill, and my wife and I were talking about it. And she has had a terminal prognosis. And my wife were talking, and I were talking about this, and Maggie said to me, why is it that we don't say to God, when is it my turn? You know, if heaven is that good, we spend all our time trying to avoid going there. But really, when is it my turn? Heaven is something that we can glory in, because Jesus has gone to make the place ready just for us. Because he knows us so well. He knows exactly what we need. And he's prepared a place just for us. So just as Paul knew, whatever happened, and 11 years or so on from this, he's going to die. But he knows that even if he dies, even when he's executed, he's still being delivered. That's great news. Wonderful news. So these verses tell us so much about Paul. And he has godly conversations with friends there in that prison, to which the guards are forced to listen. They've got no choice. They've got to hear it. They've got to listen to him pray. And you read this and you begin to think, actually, who's chained to whom here? Who is it who is trapped here? Is it Paul or is it the guard? Who has to take on board everything that he hears, who is spoken to by the Spirit of God through the man Paul and through his friends and through other people from the local church. And this is a great testimony. And Paul's life is a testimony to God's grace here in this prison, and his rejoicing and his joy for the future, dependence upon God, and absolute assurance it's all going to turn out great. So it's not just even the Praetorian Guard, it says all the rest. And I take that to mean all the other people who are in the prison. You know, the people who bring the food and the people who clean the place or whatever they do. Everybody, the guard's family and all the rest. And they're all touched. And the gospel is advanced and the obstacles are cleared out, because Paul's got some of the most influential people in the whole of the empire chained to him, and they're going to go out and they're going to tell people what they've heard, and obstacles are being moved out, and people are saying, well, the Praetorian Guard are getting saved, we ought to listen to what's going on here. Good news is this stuff. So it's not a punishment, but it's an opportunity. It's not a defeat, it's part of the plan. And word leaks out from that prison, and the Christian community hears, and their preaching is revolutionized, and the obstacles are cut down, and God is glorified. So don't be deceived by circumstances. Sometimes almost despite appearances, God is still proven to be good. But you might be tempted to ask, how does all of this apply to me? It's okay as a history lesson, but what's the practical application? I'm no Paul. I'm unlikely to be in his position. And it's certainly true that Paul is in danger here, and most of us don't face any immediate danger because we're Christians. Could all go wrong for Paul. But because God's hand is on him, what a testimony Paul can have. His life, while fraught with danger, is so different to ours. But around the world, Paul's experience is shadowed by brothers and sisters in very similar circumstances to Paul is in. But our lives seem to be so mundane. We're not called to be missionaries. We're not called to be evangelists. We're not, most of us, even called to be church leaders. But you see, it's not just about suffering, this verse. It's about something much bigger. It's not just about Paul going through a tough time. So we might say, I'm an office worker, I'm a supermarket worker, I'm retired, I'm a mum, I'm an accountant. How can my life be used by God to advance the gospel? Well, there are two clues here, and I'm not going to go on much longer because time has gone, but verse 13 is absolutely key to this whole passage. Because Paul says in verse 13, I am in chains for Christ. See, that is really important. He says, I'm in chains for Christ. So for Paul, whatever happens, God's in control. In chapter 4, verse 11 of this great book, he says, I've learned in whatsoever condition I find myself therewith to be content. So it's about intentionality. It's about making your mind up. And Paul says, I am here for Christ. God is using Paul for the advance of the gospel because Paul's intention is simple. And he says, for me to live is Christ. It's all about Christ. So what's the important thing here? Is it where Paul's body is or is it where Paul's heart is? Clearly the latter. If Paul's heart was not for Christ, this whole prison experience would have little point. It would have achieved nothing. But we look back to Acts 5, verse 41. Similar circumstances. And it says, the apostles left the Sanhedrin rejoicing because they'd been accounted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name. What name? Christ's name. Paul is counted worthy to suffer because his suffering will advance the gospel. But as I said, it's not just about suffering. Where has God placed you? And where has God placed me? In an office, then let it be for Christ. In a school, then let it be for Christ. In a doctor's surgery waiting for the next appointment, let it be for Christ. In a nursing home, let it be for Christ. In a hospital bed, let it be for Christ. If our intentionality is right, then it doesn't matter where we are. It can be for Christ. And it can be used for the advance of the gospel. And that is the joy here. That even though our circumstances are so different, even though our callings are so different, nevertheless, we can hold hands with Paul and say, my experiences now can be used for Christ, for the advance of the gospel, to pull down the obstacles, to make the way clear. Paul is such an example to us. And I could go on, and we could talk about the fact that obstacles are removed, and people who stood against the gospel are moved out of the way, and all those restrictions actually turn out not to be restrictions at all, but opportunities. But the thing, I guess, that cheers me more than anything else, no, as much as anything else, just these couple of lovely verses at the end. All the people are against Paul, and they're sorted. But even within the church, there are those who stand against him. And they see this as an opportunity, Paul being locked up. We've lost Di. You know Di, don't you? Push him. We've lost him. He's come back to Cardiff, and our loss is his gain. Oh, it's like a bereavement losing Di. It's horrible. And, you know, I'd have him back tomorrow, give him a chance. Miss him so much, and his lovely family. But what's our reaction when our leader is taken out? Well, it could be one of despair. We haven't got Di anymore. The church is going to collapse. We may as well pack up now and go and join another church. We may as well get in our car on Sunday mornings and come to Siloam. There's no point in carry on in Pontypool because we haven't got Di anymore. And Paul's mates could have done exactly the same things. Paul's locked up in prison. We haven't got a leader. We haven't got an evangelist. We may as well pack up and do nothing. But there's no evidence of that. In fact, the evidence is the opposite. So that's one option that's out of the way. Second option, and I really have one question. Second option, well, the leader's out of the way. Now it's my turn to shine. Now it's my turn to make a name for myself. Now it's my turn to step into leadership, and people will realize I'm just as good as Paul. And we've got four elders in our church, and any one of us could say, right, great, he's gone now. It's down to me. And now people will know that I'm as good a preacher as he was and just as charismatic. And there were people just like that in Paul's day. Just the same. People who took the opportunity to try and make a name for themselves. They weren't preaching heresy. Because in Colossians, when they did, Paul took them and sorted that one out. They weren't preaching heresy, they were preaching in truth, but their hearts weren't right. They just wanted to make a name for themselves. So that's option number two. And there were some people like that. But number three, our leader's gone, I'm going to step up for the team. Our leader's gone, well, we can work together for the continuation of the church. And we will. And it doesn't matter whether our names are remembered or not, and it doesn't matter what people's response to us is. It doesn't matter. We're going to work together. And we're just going to try and support Paul. So you've got these two factions. And Paul says, actually, as long as you're both preaching the gospel, I couldn't care less. It really doesn't matter. God will sort that out. I know who's who. But as long as the gospel's being preached, that's all that matters. And that's great. That's great. And sometimes we see people preaching the gospel. We think, yeah, we see them on TV, on some of the programs, and we think, I don't know about their motivations. Oh dear, I think they just want to get fame and fortune. Doesn't matter. All that matters is that the gospel is preached. And it doesn't matter whether the person preaching it is a charismatic character or not, whether they're young or whether they're old, whether they have a degree or whether they're just an ordinary individual. It doesn't matter. All that matters is that the gospel is preached. And Paul is so excited. And so should we be every time we see the gospel being preached in truth and in faithfulness. And even if we've got questions about the motivation, important thing is that the gospel is being preached. Let God sort the rest out, because he will in his own good time. So that's about it, really. Don't be deceived by the circumstances, either yours or the churches locally. God's in control. We will rejoice in the future, right now, because we know he's in control. And regardless of whatever happens in the church or out of it, we know we're going to be delivered. Let's just pray together. Father, thank you that you are a faithful God. Thank you that we can depend upon you, that you've never let us down in the future, and you never will in the future. You've never let us down in the past, and you never will in the future. Thank you that our deliverance is assured, that our future is wrapped up, and one day we will see your Son, and we rejoice in that. Gives us such hope, and we depend upon your promises. Bless your church here in Llanrymney. Encourage your people, each and every one of them. May they grow in grace, and may they grow in joy, and grow in peace. Use them for your glory. Give them fruit for their labor, and let them know that they are in the palm of your hand and the center of your heart. In Jesus' name.